You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
And of course, it's a great pleasure to welcome Paul Northup, Greenbelt's creative director, to Pagoda, who will be chairing the panel. So over to you, Paul.
So thank you to so many of you for coming. I don't know why I do this to myself. This time last year, I was interviewing Jeremy Corbyn at the end of the festival. And I barely know my own name, let alone where we are by this stage. But it's so good to see you. I am nervous and excited in equal measure. I don't know why I've been put up for this. Perhaps it's because I'm half American, so I'm going to understand these guys really, really well. My dad was a shrimp fisherman. So if you just channel Forrest Gump for a little while, and that's where I'm coming from. No, I'm really, really delighted. We have speech from Arrested Development on the panel. And Arrested Development, as you know, are headlining on the Glade tonight. We've only waited 20, 30 years to make that happen. We've got Lee Baines, who's been around all weekend. Yeah. We've got the wonderful Chris Matthews, who's actually here in person with us. Yeah. And we've got Flamey Grant, who's... So I'm going to dive straight in. We look over at America and we think that would never happen here. It is bonkers. And it's easy to think in caricatures. But I do want to start there, and I want to just use the phrase, Trump's America. Mm. When you hear that phrase, what do you feel? What do you feel? Mm. Speech, can I come to you first?
Terrified. Really. So... Should I just do one word?
Yeah.
Okay. No, you can. Okay. So terrified. We had a Trump situation, I guess, in 2018 or so, whatever year that was. And that was tough. And when he got reelected, it was, I thought that it was going to be just like, okay, I got to really put my nose down, get through these 4 years. And, just cope with the ignorance and the misdirection and the lies and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. It turned out I was way off. Within a year and a half's time, I've become increasingly terrified by what I've seen, and it's extremely scary. So I'll start there. And yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Lee.
I felt a kind of sinking in my chest and my heart when you said Trump's America. And as I said it again, I feel totally what Speech was saying, where the first term, and Chris and I were talking about this earlier, how the first Trump term, I had a ton of ideological problems with Trump. I had problems with his cozying up to billionaires. I had problems with his anti-immigrant rhetoric, with his racist rhetoric, with the policies that were trying to outlaw people being themselves with regards to their gender and sexuality. And this time, though, I feel like he and the people around him are seizing on executive power in a way that I've never seen in my lifetime, where a lot of the checks and balances that we were taught about growing up in civics class are sort of, we're left looking around being like, where are they? What's going on here? And so when people get out and get involved in direct action and are like, okay, well, we can't trust Congress or the courts to do what they're supposed to do. And we're going to get out here and get involved on the front lines, like we've seen with Cop City in Atlanta. We see the power coming down harder and harder on regular people who are just trying to, you know, live in accordance with the Bill of Rights. And so that's where the kind of sobering happens with me in this term compared to the first one, as I see this grabbing of executive power in a way that is more severe, I would say, than the first term.
Yeah. I would say, you know, I concur with all of that. But when I hear that term, Trump's America, I just feel absolutely furious. I mean, he... is so far removed from the people who actually made America, America, mm-hmm. Which would be my ancestors, both my Black and my Indigenous ancestors. And so when I hear it phrased as if he has somehow ownership over my country, I just feel furious. That's the long and short of it for me.
That's great.
Yeah, if these aren't the kind of the stages of grief almost we're all experiencing. I mean, I agree 100% with all of you. And I think the first time I experienced more fear, I think the first time, and it's been disappointment this time. I think I learned so much about my country during that first term that I had my, you know, the scales fell off, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of delusions about the people I call my neighbors, and while I was deeply disappointed, I was not as surprised at the second this 2.0 that we're talking about now, and I feel more aligned with the fury and the rage right now, and Trump's America is not. I feel compelled to fight real hard to make sure that is not the legacy that lasts.
No,
so. Yeah. And thank you for being so open there. I don't know if you were feeling that in the room, but you were feeling stuff there. You know, I could sense the emotion, the visceral reaction to that. And then overlaid on that, you know, you all name yourself, although it's a slippery term and it means a lot of things and it builds bridges, but it also puts up barriers. You name yourselves as Christian. And then that's another weird dimension about Trump's America, is that it purports to be Christian. And as people who practice and try to practice that faith, how does that work? And how do you respond in that sense? You know, what does it feel like for you when someone is claiming that word for themselves? Perhaps Chris, could I come to you first?
Yeah, I mean, for me, as someone who grew up in the South, I mean, I'm a Black Southerner. I was born and raised in Southeastern North Carolina. I live in Nashville, Tennessee now. The South has been my home for the majority of my life. And the people who brought me into this world and the people who raised me, I was raised in the AME church. And so I have always grown up with a very clear understanding of what it is supposed to mean to be a Christian, which it is supposed to be somebody who is deeply committed to justice while also walking very steadfastly on their faith path. And so to see somebody proclaim to be a Christian and be so very outwardly antithetical to that, I mean, it's just, one, it's such an offense to all of the people who are actually doing the good work of trying to walk that path. And for me personally, it just makes me kind of double down and really just make sure that people understand that Christian nationalism is not the same as Christianity. You know, that you've got these folks over here working so hard on trying to play God, they forgot that the faith is named for Jesus. And so for me, it's just a matter of being even more vocal about what a Christian is actually supposed to be, so that these folks who are out here being the exact opposite of that aren't the folks who get to write that narrative for so many people who are already so hesitant to embrace any conversations about faith and spirituality. And so it's really important that those folks are not the standard bearers of what it is supposed to mean to be a Christian.
Mm.
It feels so, we had such opposite upbringings. I unfortunately come from the people who are now putting Trump in power. And so, I mean, I have very close family members who voted for him both times. And so for me, that journey has been awakening to everything that you just talked about, that evangelicalism is not the, while it may be the loudest and certainly most organized and able to consolidate power right now in our country, I've experienced some joy in waking up to the world that most of you all live in, and to discover that there are bodies of there are congregations, there are people out here who, you know, absolutely opposed to the policies and the rhetoric and all of it. And so for me, it feels really personal and hard and I haven't done myself any favors, by the way, by choosing to do my art in drag, because those spaces, you know, those spaces obviously are not open to me. I'm not invited. I'm not welcome into those spaces, but I know those spaces so well. And I know that so many folks are, it takes something really monumental in your life, in your personal life, to be able to have that paradigm shift. And for me, that was my queerness. Obviously, I hate to say it, but I would have, had I not been queer, I would have probably become my papaw, who you know, is not with us anymore, but for sure would have been someone, I think, on this path. And so for me, it's about how can I connect with the people who are closest to me and help them experience the same kind of paradigm shift that I had to experience, when maybe they don't have the same reason, they don't have the same impetus. There's an ease, I think, to just sticking with their status quo and staying with what they know. And we've got to give them good cause to question those things when they may not have it in built into them like I did.
Yeah. I echo that with what you just said. There is a status quo that's very easy. You know, I grew up in Churches of Christ, International Churches of Christ organization, and spiritually, since 1996. And so it was tough for me to even get into Christianity, because previously I was very involved with the Black Freedom Liberation Movement. And that's like the Black Panthers, it's Malcolm X, it's Marcus Garvey, it's Angela Davis. And so that crowd sort of frowns on Christianity by nature, because it connects it to the misuse of Christianity to justify slavery, to control. And me coming into that world, I already was sort of rebellious, meaning coming into the Christian world was already rebellious to that community that I was already a part of. Then being Christian, being in leadership, actually leading a ministry, becoming a minister, leading ministries, I started to see when Obama first took office, I started to see a huge revelation, I'll say, with a lot of the Christians who were unjustifiably so, just had this deep disdain for Obama. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing if they just politically felt some way about him, but it was way more than that. And these were Christians who I shared much life with. Some of my deepest realities I shared with these people. And that was very deep for me and disillusioned. And then as Trump got into office, which I believe wholeheartedly was because of Obama being in office, it was a response. Then I saw even more of my fellow Christians becoming deeply enamored with Trump, despite all of the facts of his life being counter what Christianity is and what Jesus preaches and teaches us. So it was extremely disheartening. And so it's one of those situations where now I find myself, I had to leave that church organization, the ICLC, which was International Churches of Christ, because I didn't feel the brother and sisterhood that I needed to feel comfortable. And so I've been searching since then. And so now I'm almost like feeling like I need to start another church in order to find people that are like me, sort of out there on the edges, looking for some place and people to worship with. Mm. So it's an interesting, yeah, it's a very interesting journey. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank y'all for sharing all of this. And, Yeah, I mean, Paul, when you talked about that and the way in which the far right in the U.S. right now, I'm like, I don't even think Trump himself is skillful enough to tap into Christian nationalism directly because he doesn't know his Bible or anything. But certainly people like J.D. Vance are doing that, and some of these other figures. Peter Thiel is holding seminars outside the Vatican, you know, bizarre things like that. That enrages me to see a faith that I have come to know as being built on grace and mercy and mutuality and leveling and giving and healing and reconciling being used to inflict harm on people who are already having a hard time is, I mean, enraging isn't a strong enough word for how I feel about that. And, you know, it's interesting hearing everybody's experiences, because the church that I grew up in is the American version of the Anglican church. I grew up in an Episcopal church in Birmingham, Alabama, and but in a congregation that was extremely conservative and evangelical. So when I was like in middle school, getting into high school, the question of ordaining and marrying gay Christians was becoming a common, you know, topic of conversation in the U.S. And I had to sit there on Sundays and listen to the minister at our church for a solid year. He preached against homosexuality every single sermon. And I'm sitting there and I know there's gay people in our congregation, and I know they're much better Christians than this person over here who's cheating on their wife, or this person over here who runs a corporation that's been ripping off their black employees for decades. And yet this MF-er is sitting up there in the pulpit, running his mouth about this. And, it cut so deep against the spirit of the gospel that I, you know, I mentally checked out at that point. And, you know, growing up in Birmingham as a white man, whose my grandmother was a choir director in the Methodist Church for 70 years in Birmingham, and I didn't find out till I was in my 20s, I guess, or 30s, that during the 60s, I was over at her house one day for Martin Luther King Day because I had the day off work and I wanted to go eat with my grandmama. She was in her 80s. And I asked her about the civil rights movement in the 60s, which is something I never heard people, white people of that generation, talk about. My black friends' parents and grandparents would talk about it. Even people in my parents' generation, white people in my parents' generation, would talk about it. But I never heard their generation talk about it. And she said, well, the main thing I remember is Sunday mornings I'd be sitting up there, you know, by the choir loft, and I would look out in the congregation, and there was this man who was sitting on the front pew of the balcony acting like he owned the church, like he was better than everybody and all this kind of stuff. And I would think, you have some kind of nerve sitting there after what you've been doing all week downtown. And I was like, well, what had he been doing? And she was like, well, he was involved in the city government in some kind of way. I can't remember. Well, I had to go ask another family member about this. And this is the church that I first sang in. First time I sang in front of anybody. I was 3 or 4 years old singing at this church. Been going there my whole life. Found out that the prominent member of the church putting the most money in the collection plate every Sunday through the 60s was Bull Connor. Terrible. The man who chose to turn the police dogs and fire hoses on children and women marching for their rights in the streets of Birmingham, you know. And that is, to me, we can talk about like violations of civil rights and civil liberties, political rights, human rights, whatever. But at that point, man, you were doing spiritual damage to me. You were doing damage to a soul and to people's relationship to God. And it affected even me in the sense that it took me a long time to find communities where we can celebrate ourselves as all all being created by our God who loves every single one of us for exactly who we are and who wants us to be who we are and who wants us to be together and who wants us to take care of each other. And every time I see some of this hateful stuff coming out of these people's mouths, I think back to the scripture where it says that anybody who causes one of these little ones to stumble, these little precious queer children, little precious immigrant children sitting in those pews, everyone who puts up a block between them and this perfect love and grace, it'd be better for a millstone to be around your neck, you know? And that's, I gotta say, like in my angriest times, I want to put a millstone around its neck, man. I do. I want to put a millstone around this ideology's neck.
I'm hearing quite a bit there, which we can perhaps come back to when we throw it out open to questions about your search for groups of people and communities that you can belong to that are going to nourish you and that you can be part of, because you're not finding that in the institutions and the structures where you've been raised. And I think that we're British by and large here, but I'm sure that a lot of us can feel that too. So there might be some questions there, but before we do get to the Q&A, what I wanted to do is to come on to the fact that all of you are wonderful artists, you're creative people. So what does being an artist look like in Trump's America? How is your art part of your expression? And this rage, this fear, this anger that you're talking about, how is that perhaps reflected in your art?
I mean, I think we're a bit of a biased sampling group. Each and every one of us, I think, put a lot of intentionality into kind of using our art to try to make this world a better place. I was telling speech as we were coming in, I was just like, it's just such an absolute honor to even meet you. I feel like I was radicalized by Arrested Development. So it's like, you know, we're a different sampling group, but... You know, I think in this time, in the face of what America is currently looking like, I think the necessity of art being willing and able to do what art has done so very often in my country's history, which is do that work of both calling out and calling in. You know, I have quoted this quote all weekend, but I'm going to quote it again. Martin Luther King, in his book, Why We Can't Wait, he says, "Freedom songs are the soul of the movement. They are more than just incantations of clever phrases designed to invigorate a campaign. They are the sorrow songs, the shouts for joy, the battle hymns and the anthems of our movement. If a change maker like that understood the importance and necessity of music in the face of change and justice, it's no wonder that there are so many of us trying to do that work now in the face of fascism, in the face of authoritarianism." And so for me personally, you know, because of how I was raised, you know, the gospel songs we were singing in church, we were singing freedom songs. You know, we're just a couple of generations removed from people who had just gotten their freedom. And so our church looked a little different than I think some other people's church looked. And I think that's why we are so deeply connected to justice movements. I was telling the kids earlier today, there's a reason that so many of those civil rights leaders, you know, people are like, "Oh, Dr. King, Dr. King." I'm like, "Honey, he is Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King." Right. William Barber, he is Reverend Dr. William Barber. Right. There is a reason that in the Black community, it is not a far leap at all to see faith and justice be hand in hand. That is what we have known. That is what we will always know. And so when it comes to my art personally, because of how I was raised, that is what I will always try to do.
That's fantastic.
I don't know if any of you have anything to add to that, but apart from an amen.
Just that I have the best teacher right here, don't I? I learn from you every day. And
likewise.
And what I love is, I mean, Chris and I are very different songwriters. You are so good at seeing the social landscape and speaking so broadly to humanity, and I'm not. I just mean in that I tend to write these really intimate, personal songs about my own experience, but I learned from you how to make that connection with, you know, with you when I sing to y'all and look in your eyeballs. And I guess the only other thing I'll say is that when it comes to the art, like, I do think it's so important that no matter your platform, and look, y'all have a very skewed understanding of what my career looks like over there, because I come here and I feel like royalty a little bit. I feel like the queen. But you need to know right before I came out here, I did a tour in the upper Midwest where, I mean, I think my least attended show was 13 tickets, y'all, okay? That's the reality. But it doesn't matter the size of your platform. What matters is, for me, it's about partnering with people who are doing the work that I want to contribute to. And so, I mean, there are so many great organizations. I've partnered with a couple over the past few years. The Campaign for Southern Equality, I love them so much. I love the work they're doing. They're based in my hometown. And I just want to tell y'all, just as a little glimmer of hope, this past year, I was doom scrolling one day and came across this article about a camp in North Carolina that is a summer camp program just exclusively for trans kids. And they keep the location private, off the grid, private. They don't, you know, you have to like sign an NDA if you're applying to send your kid. And I just wept reading about this camp that would have been such a lifesaver for me as a kid, you know? Right. And I immediately sent an email and I was like, hi, I'm a drag queen. I'm down the road from you. I assume, I don't know where in North Carolina you are because you're doing a good job of keeping that private, but I want to support. And and they were like, yeah. I was like, what do you need? And they're like, money. And so I did. My Pride Month tour in this past June, I went out all across the country, and every show I talked about them and the work they're doing, and I invited people to give, and they did, and we raised enough money to fully scholarship one camper that summer, this past summer. And so there are people doing wonderful, wonderful work, and you find what speaks to you, right? You just find what resonates with you, and you give what you have.
That's right.
I'll piggyback off of that. So, I mean, obviously, I've been doing this, like, conscious hip-hop music for over 37 years. And there's a point where I get tired, especially when you know that you're speaking about some of the exact same things that you were speaking about in the early 90s, right? And yet, at the same time, I stay fired up and like, wanting to just keep pushing forward. And that's what we do art-wise. It is tough. The landscape has changed. You know, when we came out in the 90s, there was a lot more diversity of content. And over since the early 90s to now, a lot of that, a lot of those mediums and places to express yourself have been taken away and destroyed. And so because of that, I find myself now in 2026 with Arrested Development, having some audience members that are younger and they heard our music and want to, you know, they want to celebrate what we stand for now. Like, they're like, we want to revisit this. And then others were having to sort of convince people why we should be on this festival. What, not this particular festival, but why we should be on this festival, why Arrested Development deserves to be on this platform. We're having to convince them because in my genre in hip hop, it has become so narrow as far as the content and what people are speaking about that they almost find what we speak about as just being an anomaly and weird and something like that. So it's interesting to find where we are now in 2026 and just having to, you know, reconvince people that this is important and that music with messages of hope and upliftment are important and they're needed on platforms that are reaching more and more people. So that's what I'm finding the fight is right now. Mm. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. And I relate to what all y'all have said in speech, what you were saying. I'm 41. So when I started playing music, I was playing in the DIY and punk scene in Alabama, you know, where kids were able to make music in abandoned warehouses and stuff like that. And we heard from our elders, a generation older, the Gen X people, who were like, man, you got to keep it independent. You can't work with, you know, these major labels, these big corporations, all this kind of stuff. And a lot of people in my generation were just like, okay, grandpa, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, whatever. That seems silly, you know, like this idea of selling out, or these, like, what does that even mean, you know? And I was grateful that I had this little group of friends who were making art together who were like, nah, I think they're onto something. You know, I think there's some wisdom to that. And I feel like exactly what you're saying, Speech, like in recent, probably like the last 5 or 6, 7 years, I feel like I'm seeing this consolidation of cultural power in a way that I haven't seen, particularly in the U.S., where now you're not going to find a festival of this size in the United States that's independent. You're just not going to do it. They've all gotten bought up by Live Nation or AEG. There's venues that I've been playing for 20 years that you couldn't, I mean, you'd have to fit 100 people in there with a shoehorn, you know, and a crowbar. And they're getting bought up by these massive multinational corporations, yeah, you know, and they're pushing out independent venue. And so then what happens? Well, you got to start, if you want to play in the places, you got to start doing what the big dogs want you to do. And what do the big dogs want you to do? Well, they want you to sell Pepsi, basically. You know what I mean? They don't want you to challenge. They don't want you to provoke. They don't want you to be yourself. They don't, you know. And so I'm inspired that, you know, I'm sitting up here with y'all, all of whom are very, each of whom is committed to making authentic and independent art born out of your own experience, your own sense of calling, your own sense of purpose. And everybody here I meet at Greenbelt, every time I'm here, is embodying that, whether that's in their work or whether that's in their art or whether that's in the way that they're involved in their community, you know. And I feel like that's a way forward, human beings being human beings and taking power back from these institutions that are trying to just, you know, do what they want to do. We have the power. We do have the power. Yeah, right? We do.
And Chris, that was really, really right that you said, this is a bit of a, you know, we're all on the same page here, you know. Where are we going to get the heat and light here? But Flamie, you said something about, you touched earlier on the way that your art has work to do in connecting with, building bridges with people who we otherwise, you know, just wouldn't get to have a conversation with. I guess I wanted to go there, and perhaps what might be our final question before we open up, about how art can do stuff that perhaps in our culture wars time and our tribal time, where people are so polarized and so opinionated about what they are as opposed to what someone else is and what they believe as to what someone else believes, how does your work and your art, you know, what does it look like in that context? And do you want your art to connect with people who perhaps might vehemently not want you or not want to understand you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, so I'll tell you two stories. So the first one, I have this song that's called One and the Same. And it was written because one day my now ex-wife, which this is not why we got divorced, but it should have been a canary in the coal mine. One of her cousins changed his profile picture to a picture of the Confederate flag. And obviously I'm not afraid of a tough conversation. So I was like, hey buddy, what was up with that? And you know, those of us who are from the South, we could have set our clock to it. You know, it's heritage, not hate. I love black people. Which if you have to say the second part, whatever you said before that is utter nonsense. So, you know, he's like, it's heritage, it's not hate. And so I'm like, rather than even try to deconstruct the rest of it, I'm just going to speak to this exact thing that he thinks he knows, the truth that he thinks he knows, which is, it's heritage, not hate. So then my question as a songwriter is, well, what is your heritage? which of course he, like the majority of people, has no idea. Most people know their family history back to their grandparents, their great-grandparents, if they're lucky, and that's about it. And so in addition to being an adorable folk singer, I am also an ancestry nerd. And so I took it upon myself to look up his family history. And that song, One and the Same, is a telling of his family history, which literally one of his ancestors not only decided to captain a slave ship, he did so 3 years after it was outlawed for him to do so. And so I played that song for him when I was finished with it, and he immediately changed his profile picture.
Come on.
Because so, you know, that's the beauty of music. Sometimes music is able to do that covert work of having a conversation that somebody is going to just, you try to sit down and talk to somebody about the Confederate flag. I mean, they see this black butch lesbian walk up to them and be like, I want to talk to you about the Confederate flag. They're going to walk out the opposite way. But if I'm singing a song to them, for whatever reason, they will sit through 3 minutes of a song and maybe have a conversation via that song that they are not capable of simply having conversation to conversation, face to face. That is the power of music. And the second story I will share with you, I was at the Supreme Court singing in solidarity with the Brady campaign. The Brady campaign does a lot of phenomenal work on gun advocacy, trying to make guns not so accessible in our country. I don't know why we have such an obsession with guns. I feel like you all have some explaining to do on that front since, you know, we come from you. But no, I'm standing on the steps of the Supreme Court for this action, and there's a man there with a bullhorn, and the entire time, every single time a speaker gets up, he is on his bullhorn, on his bullhorn, on his bullhorn. I get up there to sing a song called Safe, which is about, you know, gun reform, and he stays off of his bullhorn for the entirety of the song. As soon as I finish the song, he gets on his bullhorn and he says, "You have a beautiful voice, but you're wrong." I'll take it. I'll take it. I got to make my entire case to you, and nobody else this entire day has gotten able to do that. And so that's the power, I think, of music. I think that's why so many of us who do this work continue to do this work, even though it is sometimes so incredibly heartbreaking, because we know that if we keep on doing it, we might just reach one or two people who somebody else has not yet been able to reach, and that alone is worth every other heartbreak. Yes.
Wow. My name is Speech, but I wish I could speak like you. So well put.
Thank you.
You know, I think for me, I have to always remember that there is always somebody in a crowd this size, there's at least one or two people who are like me coming up, which is, I was inspired to write because of other writers that came before me. Mm-hmm. I was inspired to write about what I write about because of other writers. I was inspired by Bob Marley. I was inspired by Public Enemy. I was inspired by so on and so forth. And so because of that, I know that I'm also doing the same, that I'm inspiring somebody to take up the mantle of justice, take up the mantle of heart issues and heart music. And so that inspires me to keep going. I just know that there's people like myself that are in my shoes. And I just hope to inspire them the way I've been inspired by so many others before me. So the ancestors win again, and that's how I feel. Yeah. Mm.
I don't know that there's much more to add other than, I kind of made the joke earlier about, you know, I haven't done myself any favors by choosing to be a singer-songwriter in drag in terms of where I get invited. But the truth of it is that the more niche I get, and I'm getting pretty darn niche, y'all, this new record that I've been working on is for my trans siblings. It is, and the songs are specifically written about that experience and to that experience. And, but the more niche I get, I still get invited into some churches, and I am a lot of people's first encounter with drag. And I love that. I love that this weird non-traditional path I've chosen, or stumbled into really, gives me the opportunity to be a lot of people's first encounter with something that they've heard a lot about, but don't know anything about. And so I get those moments too, at the end of shows where some of my favorite moments are, you know, I'm sitting here singing a song. If you were at the Rebel Rouser the other day, I did a song called I Am Not a Man, which is, or I Used to Be a Man. I don't know the name of my own song.
Relatable.
But, right. But, you know, I'm singing these songs about the trans experience, and then at the end of the show, I'll have a, you know, just the your average 70-year-old cis straight white guy, right, come up and share that. Wow, like I know you're not singing to me, and I know I'm not your primary audience, but I just want to let you know like what I connected with in your message, and that's just that the alchemy of art, right? It's just a wonderful thing we get to do.
It is.
Lee, do you have anything to add before we go?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, I guess particularly, well, I don't know, in the last many years, honestly, I think a lot about a lot of what's been shared up here and how, you know, I grew up, the first concert I ever went to, I was 12, mm-hmm. and I went to with my dad to see Lynyrd Skynyrd, who was my favorite band, as many young white ruffians from Alabama would agree with. The thing is, I loved Lynyrd Skynyrd because what I heard in them was a reflection of my place and a sort of... I don't know, like a sense of being oneself and claiming a home and a place and a culture. But I remember going to that show and they had a t-shirt that they were selling that had a Confederate flag on it. And you know, again, this was like my favorite band, and I'm looking at this shirt, and there's a part of my brain that's like, man, that shirt's pretty bad. And then there's another part of my brain that's like, yeah, but if I wear that shirt around my friends, they're going to be like, yo, what's going on with that? You know what I mean? What are you trying to say with that? And so over the years, I've thought about how I can own who I am, you know, and I'm a eighth generation Alabamian. I love Alabama. I am a, you know, cishet white Christian man. And how can I own who I am and my home and help people like me to understand that we can love ourselves, but in order to do that, we have to love all of our neighbors and we have to make sure that this place is open for everybody. And I'm really inspired, and I've been inspired in recent years by the Bell Hooks book, Will to Change. Which anytime I'm talking to particularly a young man or boy that I'm around at this point in time, I try to bring back to this idea that anybody who's living under a system of hierarchy and exploitation is suffering. And, you know, it's for a white boy growing up in Alabama who's cisgender and heterosexual, it's we're taught that what's good for us is white patriarchy. That's what's going to get us ahead. And that's what we're told. And it's like it doesn't take long if that's reframed slightly and reflecting on our own experience that it's like, yeah, but you know what? That bigger kid kicked the shit out of me every day of high school because I didn't walk the right way. Or that kid, you know, ridiculed me because of this music that I liked or because he saw me crying one time or whatever. You know what I'm saying? And so we can start to understand these ways in which these systems not only terrorize the people that are excluded from the system, but also terrorize those who are, quote, included in it, you know, and we're cutting off parts of ourselves in order to conform to these ideas. And so the longer that I've been out there playing, and I do, you know, I play loud electric guitar, you know, kind of, I I try to kick it out the frame a little bit, you know, and I do have a bunch of little young white boy ruffians, you know, who like the music, and it's been cool to see them get older over the years, and there's some little British white boy ruffians I've gotten to know here at Greenbelt over the years who I've grown up to see be the most beautiful people and whole people and who are committed to creating a world where every single person deserves to be who they are and deserves an equal voice and an equal footing, and that's what y'all are demonstrating how to do every, you know, every year, year after year.
Yeah.
So, thank you so much. I mean, there's so much rich material there. Let's go to some questions. I think we'll take two or possibly three at a time. I'll do my best to remember them and play them back. So are there microphones that are going around? Yeah? Yeah? Okay.
Hi, yeah. Thanks for everything you said. I'm just kind of... love to pick your brains on where you think the future's coming, where it's going to with Trump 2.0. Do you see envisaged constitutional change that will allow Trump 3.0, 4.0? And when the end does come, do you think it will be possible to undo the changes, to unpick them? Or do you think there's going to be damage for years, decades to come?
Thank you. It's a great question. Let's take one more.
As an American living abroad, what is the spirituality that sustains the struggle against Trump's America?
Okay. Let's just take those two. Don't feel you all need to answer so we can get through some more questions, but the first one was about, you know, is there really a possibility of Trump 3.0 or 4.0? Or I think possibly the even more important part of that question was, is there a possibility, how are we going to get it back? What does life after Trump look like, and how can you guys be a part of that?
I mean, if I may. I mean, personally, I think that November is going to tell us an awful lot. I think we are all waiting with bated breath to see how the midterms shake out, because there has been just so much. This version, this 2.0, is so much more horrific than the first draft of this nightmare. And I think it is largely because of the people that he has surrounded himself with. Yeah. And so because of that, it will be very telling to see how fully and full-throatedly our country pushes back against that in November. That will tell us an awful lot. And so we're all just kind of waiting to see. I think also it's important to be mindful of the fact that, you know, there's so many people who think that just because we vote and get more Democrats elected, that we then get to miraculously somehow go back to the status quo of 2016. And that's not the case. You know, we cannot, as the song says, we cannot build the same broken thing back. We're trying to build back something completely better than what we have. We had the almost hubris of thinking that the way that our democracy was set up, all of those fail safes, all of those protections were enough to prevent us from ever being in this situation in the first place. And those fail safes have proven to be wanting and inadequate. And so it is absolutely insanity to assume that being able to just go back to that same thing is going to be good enough. If it was good enough, we wouldn't be here in the first place. And so we cannot do that again.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And how about the question over here about what is the spirituality that sustains the struggle that you guys are definitely in? What does that look like?
I mean, I'll just say for myself, I read the Bible every morning and spend time reflecting on that and talking to God and trying to just ask for the right thing to do for that day, you know, the next right thing for that day, because looking out even months in the future can be pretty overwhelming for me. And then the other thing is that I've found an amazing church community that I've been a part of for several years now. And, you know, it's in Decatur, Georgia, it's in the Deep South. And I have members of my church who are in their 70s and 80s, many of whom have you know, we just unfortunately lost a church member who was married to his husband for 40 years, you know, both Southern men who got married in an affirming Baptist church 40 years ago. We have a lady in our church who was the first, the mother of the first Black family to join the church in the late 50s when segregation was still the law of the land in Georgia. So being able to be with these spiritual elders who have shown how to live free under an oppressive regime, to live in faith and fear, is pretty empowering to me. So.
Can we take a couple more?
Hi, thanks for being here. So I'm still just outside Chicago, and when the election happened, like you, I got really upset. But part of the resistance, I think, is getting out the checkbook. And as a boomer, we still do have checkbooks. And look at the organizations like Trevor Project and NAACP. For me especially, it was my local food pantry, because my neighbors were just getting devastated. You know, we've got money for billionaires, but we don't have money for our neighbors to have food. Are there any organizations that people here could reach out to that you would give a shout out to that are doing the best for resistance?
Yeah, one more.
Yeah. In the UK, I see a lot of people becoming detached from politics and the rise of far right in particular, and they feel as though they don't have a voice, or their vote doesn't matter and it has no power. How do you continue to maintain hope and keep inspiring hope in people that fight against people that want us to feel and benefit from us feeling powerless? Mm.
Okay, wonderful questions. To the person here from near Chicago wanting, you know, what are the organizations and networks that you might want to shout out that you could recommend, that if you've got some money, you could put some money behind them doing good? You got any examples?
I mean, in Tennessee and in Nashville, especially, Migra Watch, that organization is doing an incredible job of trying to keep our immigrant friends and neighbors safe in Nashville. You know, so many folks have been knowing about what's happening with ICE in Minneapolis and in Chicago and in LA and some of those other places. They came to Tennessee first because we have such a red state, and so we are also getting decimated and have been. So Migra Watch, if you want to send some love to my state of Tennessee, I would be thrilled for that. They're doing amazing good work in our community.
Yeah, in Atlanta, a couple organizations that I'm a big fan of. One is called Southerners on New Ground, that works across the Southeast, and they're centered on liberation, whether liberation from white supremacy or, you know, patriarchy and whatever. And they do everything from direct mutual aid to campaigning for elections and all that. And then another one, very local to Atlanta, is called the Atlanta People's Campaign. And they were tabling at my most recent show in Atlanta, and they're working right now on a lot of opposition to the surveillance state and an extension of, you know, white supremacist police violence, you know, that's going on with these flock cameras being put up all around the U.S. with the construction of Cop City in Atlanta, and also with these AI data centers that are being built, particularly around the South, in these parts of the country that don't have the regulatory framework that they have up north, more on the coast. So, yeah.
And then the really big question of it is not that it's a more important question, but it's very pertinent to this panel about, you know, the far right playing on the disillusionment and the detachment with politics, and sort of, you know, putting rocket fuel under that. What do you have to say about that? I mean, that's big for us here.
I try to make it a point at most of my shows to talk about that and to have people really recognize that the folks in the room right next to them are their neighbors and are the ones that they need to be linking arms with. And the fact that everybody came out that night is proof enough right there that we have what we need already. Like, we're already here in our communities. We just need to know each other. And I tell people not to go home without a new friend, you know? And I think that's one of our, I think that is a key part of our job as artists, is to give people hope and remind folks that, as has already been set up here, we do have the power. And that's just something we have to sing and say over and over and over again. And you can do that too, to your friends and your family and your neighbors, and we all need to hear that, because we all get bogged down from time to time.
Have we got a couple more?
There's someone over there.
Yeah. I can see a hand there.
This gentleman here has been waiting to ask.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Give me my mic.
Yeah. Come on up here.
Grab this mic here.
Yeah.
Nice. Straight out of Where's That?
Okay. I know, I wanted to see it.
Firstly, can I just thank you for fusing the beauty of your art with the power of truth? Thank you for that.
Yeah. I think
my question builds on some of the questions that have already come, actually, which is, you know, earlier I think the comment was made that maybe Trump's MAGA was a reaction to Obama presidency. Are you seeing the hope of a mobilizing of, I mean, you've talked about some great organizations, you've talked about hope. Are you seeing a sort of mobilizing of progressives and people with right values?
Mm. Yeah. Okay, we'll hold that. And perhaps one more question over here. Yeah.
I try to live thinking that everyone I meet teaches me something about God, because they're made in the image of God. Is there anything we can learn about God from Trump?
Yes, I would love to speak to that. I've learned so much.
Absolutely.
Wow, yeah.
Well, I'm learning.
Let's go first here. The theme that came out from some of you, that Trump would never have come to pass if Obama hadn't have been, and might there be a similar sort of yin-yang reaction, or what do you think there? Or is it just not as simple as that now? Speech, do you have anything there?
I'll let you guys see.
Okay.
I'm not going to monopolize, because I want to talk about that. So.
Okay.
I don't want to monopolize the time, so.
Well, I mean, I am seeing a sort of a response. There is a lot of progressive, socialist, democratic leaders that are coming up, winning primaries, winning meritorial, I guess they call it, elections, like Mamdani in New York, and super inspiring. And what I like most about it is that they're finding ways to speak about things straightforward that I think it's been hard to speak about, and hard to sort of formulate the right sentences to make people listen and not turn away. And mixing that with actual on-the-ground items that are receivables, in a sense, that people can say, yeah, and he's doing the work. That has been very effective. I think it's definitely changed a lot of people's hearts, and that's exciting. So to see that is very exciting. And I do see a response in that sense in America. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. And Chris, I think you particularly wanted to respond.
Yes. Yes, I'd like to give my TED Talk now on why. No, I was having a conversation with my mom one day about Donald Trump and what his childhood was like. We know an awful lot about what his childhood was like. And for me, as somebody who, even in the face of so much hate being thrown my way because of all of the boxes that I check, I still try to always live my life very hope forward and very love forward. And so to see that man grow up to be the human that he is, knowing how horrible his father was to him, it is an important daily lesson for me, as someone who proclaims to want to walk the walk of Jesus, to maintain a level of empathy for that. That is work. That is the work. Being able to still see somebody who is doing so much harm, willingly, knowingly, and still be able to see him as a human being with an origin story so full of hurt, so full of despair, and then to be able to empathize with him while still doing the work of holding him accountable. I think that is a thing that we have to be so good at. It isn't enough for us to just throw back in the reverse the same things that get thrown to us. We can't just see these people who are so full of hate, so full of vitriol, and distill them down to only that. They're not only that. None of us are only that. We are all made up of the entirety of our experiences as human beings on this planet. And so the work of trying to live on a planet at the same time as that hateful, horrible man, and still be able to see him as a human being who was absolutely broken as a child, and who is now only a reflection of that broken child in a bigger body, that is important work that I'm, you know, sad I have to do, but I'm glad to be able to still try to do every day because it makes it better for everybody else.
Wow. I think speech, you need to give your name to Chris. It needs to happen.
No way.
We are out of time, but I want to say a huge thank you to our guests, to Flamey, to Chris, to Lee, to Speech.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.